You're listening to Black Op Radio.
Video computers online. Archiving 44K. Initiate sequence.
T minus 30 seconds.
Server connection confirmed.
T minus 25 seconds.
Live stream for T120K.
T minus 20 seconds.
Phone lines are go.
T-minus 15 seconds.
Satellite numbering verified.
T-minus 10 seconds.
Flight check complete. Satellite numbering verified.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to Black Op Radio, the voice of political conspiracy research. You're listening to Black Op Radio, the show NSA doesn't want you to hear. Now here is your host, Leno Sanic.
Control room, you're on the air.
Hello everyone, welcome to another episode of Black Op Radio. In this segment we're speaking to Mr. Ted Yacucci. Hello, Ted.
Hi, Len. How are you, buddy?
Very good. I'm so glad you took time to talk to me again today. I met you when you were doing a documentary down in Los Angeles, and Lisa Pease was there, and Jim DiEugenio, and at arm's length, we became, you know, friends, and you helped contribute to the 50 Reasons for 50 Years. And every so often, I make sure I check in on your channel and just want to make sure people know what you're up to, and you have a really good YouTube channel that today I wanted to help promote and make sure people don't miss out all these good videos that you have been producing. So just, you know, very briefly, just give listeners a briefest background of what just got you into the case and then got you motivated to do more about it.
Sure. Like a lot of older people, I was 8 years old when November 22nd, 1963 happened. And I just remember the absolute pall that came over the nation, even at 8 years old, in my school, my parents. It really affected me. Even at that age, some of the activity that was taking place, especially Oswald getting shot by Ruby just 2 days after the assassination, just seemed just too fantastical to be true. So anyway, that started my fascination with the case. My background has been as a TV reporter, and I teach journalism, so I'm kind of used to journalistic investigations. It's what I've really enjoyed. And actually, I'm so old that I'm getting ready to retire at the end of this year, and I'm so enthusiastic on really getting back into the JFK research with more just enthusiasm and sure than I've had the last couple of years to really dedicate to it. And that's why I enjoy Black Op Radio, and I enjoy some of the major researchers that you have on every week, and because it's been able to really keep me close to the subject. And, you know, I've done some independent research on several aspects of it, of the case. I've been to Chicago a couple of times researching the Chicago plot. I have a FOIA request trying to get some kind of information on what the last name of the informant was in Chicago. We know the first name was Lee. I've been trying to get a little bit more information on what the last name was. Of course, if it would be Oswald, then we'd know a whole lot more about what was going on there and Oswald's activity and intelligence. And my other real main focus of the case was Mrs. Payne, Ruth Payne. I did some interviews with her, 10 or 11 years ago. I was just amazed at how she was trying to manipulate me and qualify me as someone that she would continue with. And basically what it came down to was, if I didn't agree that Lee Oswald was one of the shooters in the General Walker case right before the assassination, she would not proceed with me any further with my correspondence and interviews with her. And I refuse to do that. So that's kind of where that is. So overall, it's just been a general interest. I've read, like everybody else, I've read probably 90% of the books that have ever come out. And it's just been an honor to be part of the community of so many independent citizens like yourself that really the onus of solving the case has really come down to. Obviously, you know, we've just been told so many lies with what's going to be released and when it's going to be released. And, you know, it's only through the incredibly hard work of so many independent journalists and researchers that we're as far as we are. And I, unlike some people, think that we're a lot closer to actually breaking this thing open than maybe some others. I know there's a lot of frustration, but I think we're getting close. And so just in a nutshell, that's kind of where I started from.
Oh, very good. Very good. Now, you have been, you know, you were called TV Ted was your nickname, right? And you were into television and reporting, as you mentioned in that. And so now you've used that skill into producing these segments. I see like 17 minutes, 11 minutes, you know, 14. You put these segments out. Tell us a little bit about your channel and what was the inspiration to or motivation to start putting out these videos.
Well, I think it started in the sense that I think there's so much that's provable in the case. And I know, I think you and I spoke the last time I was on, where I did a couple of videos called Trust Your Eyes, where we actually go over a lot of the stuff that can't be, that cannot be questioned, things, elements, aspects of the case that are just simply proven at this point. And that's one of the things that I really wanted to do with a lot of the videos that I produced, was to actually focus on a lot of those questions or a lot of the aspects of the case that can't be questioned, is how I should put it. And I think that's a real benefit, because there is so much information that is proven. And when you really step back and look at the case from a little bit of distance, you can start to see how all aspects of the case really fit together, especially the CIA, the CIA lead in the assassination, at least in my opinion. And that was one of the reasons, actually one of the projects that I'm working on now is about Sergeant Robert Vincent, who was, a lot of your listeners may know, he was a sergeant that was pretty much by accident on a flight from Washington, D.C., the day of the assassination, and ended up getting his plane called after the assassination, and they went to Dallas, actually landed on a little dirt grassy strip by the Trinity River just south of Dallas, and picked up what he would later claim was an exact the exact image of Lee Oswald from when he saw him the last night, and then how the CIA really made sure that they got their grips on Sergeant Vincent and actually placed him in a position where they could keep total oversight over him and his wife, which they did for the next number of years. So that's kind of, you know, part of some of the interest that I've had in producing some of the stuff that I believe that people just, you know, stop questioning every little thing, because you can always question every little thing about if someone spoke to this person or that person or whatever, but look at the actual facts that are there right in front of us that are proven, that are even verified with the Warren Commission, and it becomes a lot easier, I think, to really come to the conclusions that the JFK assassination was most certainly a CIA operation, similar to all the other CIA operations where they were overthrowing governments at the time in Guatemala and Iran and the Congo. It basically was an operation that was just brought onshore. The fact that so many people were followed and so many people were either harassed or actually may have lost their lives due to the CIA following them for the years after the assassination, to me is just more proof that the CIA was totally involved.
Yeah, I mean, you just have to look at the motivation of who wanted to get rid of, you know, JFK. And I tell people as a short answer, they say, well, who killed him? I said, well, he was removed by his enemies. And you start doing an investigation of who his enemies were. The big money that Alan Dulles and Sullivan Cromwell represented, and the Department of Defense, and they, in this case, all got together and said, that guy's got to go.
Yeah, that's exactly what happened. And as many questions as I, like I'm sure most people, have had through the years, through all the research and everything that I've, every bit of work that I've done has all led to that same conclusion. And I think at this point, it's beyond reproach. At least that's my opinion.
Well, the good thing about it is that you've, you know, you walked the walk and you've produced some really good television here, and it's on the internet, but these are really good short documentaries. And when I made 50 Reasons for 50 Years, we were talking about that. Like, we got to make this for short attention span. We got to just put 3 to 5 minutes. Here's something. Here's the parade route. Here's the rifle. Yeah. Here's the commission exhibit 399. Now look at that bullet. What do you think could happen? Your videos at your good channel, I'll make a link to it. It's just Ted DiCucci. But, you know, it's just worthwhile. Every one of these things kind of stands on the back of the other research that's done and takes it further and further. And I think a lot of people lately have been investigating or interested in the murder of J.D. Tippit, and just how did this go down, and how can there be two people? How can Lee be here and somebody else be there? And they see a short, stocky man, and then he met, and, you know, there's another cop car, you know. It just, the whole thing just stinks, no matter who you think did what, you know?
It really does. And that, I know you and...
John Armstrong,
my goodness. You guys have done such good work in that. And I don't know anybody that's done better work in exposing Captain Westbrook and Sergeant and Reserve Officer Croy. And, you know, everything about that just screams that those two were involved. And then even in the murder of Lee Oswald in the basement, you know, Jack Ruby standing right next to Officer Croy, you know. I mean, there's so much that you guys have exposed in that case that it becomes so much clearer. And, you know, and one of the things that I've been able to kind of reinforcing my own brain as I've been doing this work on Robert Vincent, Sergeant Vincent, is all of the second Oswald sightings that happened in Dallas over the 2 months or so prior to the assassination. And, you know, it just comes down to the fact that this was an operation. This was a well planned out operation. And, you know, they had missed in Chicago a little bit less than 3 weeks earlier. It didn't work out in Tampa. And, you know, this was almost the last chance to get him before the new year and the election. And they weren't going to mess it up. And, you know, and they didn't, you know. So
why, in my opinion, that's why they brought Ed Lansdale in. Because this had to work. This is the last chance. We need somebody there on the ground organizing. We've had too many near misses. Now, the one thing you mentioned about John Armstrong, and I'll probably say this every time people mention it, is that you don't have to subscribe that there's two people named Harvey and Lee. As soon as you say Lee and an imposter, Lee and a double, or even a triple, then you start saying, well, who's organizing that? This is some kind of operation going on, right? And John, for the good or bad, he seems to think that there was two people from a young age, a Harvey and a Lee. And, you know, if I tell him, well, I don't totally subscribe to that now, but I'm going to keep listening and show me what you've got. Sure. And then he brings up so much other information that you say, even if I don't subscribe to that, like what you've brought up about Croy, right, in the Tippit, and everything is just miles above research that people have done. So his book, Harvey and Lee, was just, I mean, people kind of tar him with this, well, there can't be two. There can't be two. Right. But yes, I do believe there was a double. Who was in the back alley of the Texas Theater walking out? Who was in that car that got arrested that, who was the end of the, being the mayor of Dallas saw?
Russ Wise, right.
Right, right.
Yeah.
So, yeah, there's so many names and things for us to remember here. But that's one of the things that whenever I have him on to talk about what he's doing, you know, now is it's of interest, and then it takes interested, you know, civilian historians kind of like you to say, well, I see where you're going with this, and I'm going to elaborate on that, because whether people think that there was a Harvey and a Lee, or it doesn't matter if there's a, I mean, it's just, there's so many instances of a double, of an imposter. I mean, just take the whole Mexico City thing. That is a CIA footprint diversion, trying to, you know.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And look at Chicago 3 weeks earlier. Look at Thomas Arthur Valet. When you look at the background of Thomas Arthur Valet, who would have been the supposed patsy if that is the assassination had gone through there. He almost looks like Oswald. He almost looks like a double of Oswald. And they have, their backgrounds are so similar. You can see how they were both being set up by the CIA. They both worked in Japan. They both were training anti-Castro Cubans. Oswald in Lake Pontchartrain and Valet at Long Island. They both were set up in the jobs. Valet in the IPP litho plate factory, which was on the fourth floor of, I forget the exact address now, but you know, right where Kennedy's motorcade was to make a turn and pass slowly underneath. Oswald, of course, was gotten the job in the Texas School Book Depository by Mrs. Payne, Ruth Payne, just less than a month before the motorcade was switched to go down Elm Street. So there's so much obvious manipulation in all of the things that happen that, you know, you need to have an organization like the CIA that would be able to pull it off. I mean, you look at just what happened on the day of the JFK assassination. You know, when we talk about like the proof of a second Oswald, and again, I agree with you. I don't go back more than a couple of months of what I believe that there was a second Oswald. Maybe there was someone that the CIA had been, you know, hoping to set him up with for longer, maybe even a lot longer. But, you know, I don't really subscribe either to the whole, you know, two people growing up thing. But, you know, I can just look at the last couple of months before the assassination. I mean, on the day of the assassination itself, we have Roger Craig hearing that shrill whistle, looking over and seeing the man, a man who he would just a few hours later identify as Lee Oswald, running down to get in a light green Rambler station wagon and then head west on Elm Street. The big one is that we know that a second Lee Oswald was arrested in the balcony area of the Texas Theater and brought out the back entrance, where a lot of people viewed that and thought for years that was the Lee Oswald that was getting arrested there, where he had been brought out about 3 or 4 minutes from the front of the theater, and as we all know, and arrested there. The Tippit killing that you brought up, where, you know, there was some signs of some people said that identified the person as looking like as Lee Oswald. And then, of course, what I've been working on, the Robert Vincent thing, where Sergeant Vincent is on a plane that swoops into Dallas right after the assassination, lands on not a landing strip, but lands on a grassy little piece of maybe construction road. And two men get on that plane. It takes off right away. Nobody says anything to Vincent, who's not supposed to be on that plane, by the way. And then it heads west. It doesn't go to where he thinks it's going, which is to Denver. Instead, it lands at Roswell Air Force Base, where everybody gets off, doesn't say a thing to him, And then he goes and you know, and well, we'll take it from there. Maybe we'll get into that a little bit. But then he is controlled by the CIA from a few months after that, just like the CIA was keeping an eye on David Ferry and all the other people that were potentially could blow the case open if they spoke too much. Some of those people, some of those folks didn't live like Ferry, but you know, Robert Vincent did, because he kept his mouth shut. He actually was assigned to the CIA base at Area 51 outside of Las Vegas just about a year after the assassination, where they could really keep an eye on him because he would spend most of the week there and not even go back to visit his wife except on the weekends in Las Vegas. So there's every bit of proof that we, when we look at it, that this was a CIA operation that was not, in my opinion, as tight as a lot of people would have you think. This was a big operation. It had to be. It had to be, because maybe there were just a few people that knew everything and everything is compartmentalized, but they were actually, they needed to tamp this thing down for the next decade after the assassination. And that's why, in my opinion, the Robert Vincent story is so interesting, because it's proof of how the CIA swept in once they realized that he was a witness to something that he shouldn't have been a witness for. And I think that he's awfully lucky, because I think he was in a position to certainly have been killed himself if he didn't play ball with the CIA, which he did. And that was a good thing for him, because he would have been on that short list, in my opinion, to need to be eliminated, because if someone had broken that story that a C-54 plane swept in and someone looking exactly like Lee Oswald got on along with another man that looked Cuban, and then took off right away from what was not even an actual airfield, you know, there would have been a lot of questions that came from that. So, you know, so that's my opinion. But again, I think if anyone takes the time just to step back and look at everything in the big picture, you can see where it was A, B, C, D, and E. And, you know, people can argue about little things with each of those, but the big picture doesn't change. And, you know, that's kind of where I'm coming from.
Right. And once again, we're talking about a lookalike, somebody who looked like Oswald. I mean,
yeah.
There's people at a shooting range. There's people taking cars on a test drive. And now here's a guy getting in a plane and unscheduled. I mean, it's a military plane too, right?
Right.
Don't forget that. So it's just this, you know, no customs, no nothing. It's just pull over. We need to pick up somebody. All right.
Yeah. And I'll get into it. But, you know, it just what you just brought up is really important, because for the 2 months before the assassination of JFK, I mean, there were a ton of second Oswald sightings. And it was kind of, you know, Malcolm Price at the Sportsdrome Shooting Center. And actually, there were two incidences there. His Malcolm Price was there with his son. He's asked to someone that he will say looks exactly like Lee Oswald, asked him to help him sight in his sight on his rifle. And as soon as he does it, even though it's dusk, they're actually shooting under car lights, then he real quickly puts three rounds dead center in the bullseye, which was, you know, at distance, you know. So he's actually trying to, you know, call attention to himself. On November 10th, Garland Slack set up his target, and then Oswald shoots his target, which you never do at a rifle range. You never do that. And then, you know, Slack says that, you know, he was really upset, and he says that Oswald shot him a look that he'll never forget. You know, then Morgan's gun shop, where can't remember the guy's name now, but he Morgan's gun shop, a guy's in there with his sister and his brother-in-law, and someone who is making a big ruckus as they're buying ammunition, and makes the point of saying they're an ex-Marine, and, you know, calling attention to themselves in every single way. You go to the downtown Mercury Comet dealership, where a salesman, if I remember his name, was Guy Bogart. A guy identifies himself as Lee Oswald. So he says the name Lee Oswald, and then says that he's interested in the car. He doesn't have the down payment, but he'll have the full price in a couple of weeks, and he'll pay for the car in cash. Then he takes Bogart out on a test drive on Stemmons Freeway. He's driving recklessly, hitting 75 to 85 and doing stupid stuff to make sure that he's remembered. So again, it's all part of setting up Lee Oswald as a nut who may be doing this for money. I mean, there's so many. And then of course he's seen in some coffee shops. And again, everywhere he's seen in public, he's creating a ruckus to make sure that people recognize and remember him, so that when they're questioned about it later, they'll say, well, yeah, that's Lee Oswald, you know, because he must look a whole heck of a lot like Lee Oswald. And the fact that Sergeant Vincent on that airplane ride, you know, swears that, you know, the guy looked a splitting image to Oswald, you know, that is something that, you know, can't be overlooked. The CIA must have spent an awful lot of time priming and getting someone ready to be that kind of imposter. It worked out for him for a long time, because the people that were reporting this, what they did, what the Warren report did, they would accept the part of the reports from these people that fit their story, and then they would either reject them or just not even consider them. So for instance, some of the times where the second Oswald was seen and reported with erratic behavior at the Sportsdrome rifle range, that would have been a time where they knew the real Oswald was either at Mrs. Payne's house or was in Mexico City. So they couldn't say that was Oswald. So what did they do? They just didn't consider it. They just didn't put it in their report. They just used the fact that someone reported Lee Oswald as a, erratic behavior, as a nut, but they didn't even bother putting in there that it couldn't have happened, because they're saying that Lee Oswald was somewhere else. So, you know, again, the Warren Commission, you know, if there's a hell, then Alan Dulles and three or four of the other folks, including Gerald Ford, in my opinion, are now in hell for what they did to the nation with the cover up with the Warren Commission. But anyway, sorry, I got a little off on the tangent.
No, that's fine
there.
Because, I mean, you know, one of the things in that car ride that you said, he drove down the road 75 miles an hour and all that, and it's like he said something about, oh, you know, they wouldn't treat me like this back in Russia. Maybe I should,
right.
That's another thing that, that's out of left field. Why would anybody even say that? And then, oh, Lee Oswald was a defector to Russia and he came back, you know? I mean, this is, it is crazy. And then to think that people are still sticking to the Warren Commission like a flat earth society, that it's just an embarrassment. And
and we didn't even mention the Sylvia Odio when Oswald was, you know, supposedly there with Leopoldo and whoever else was, you know, the sighting there. I mean, there's just so many of them that are out there. And, you know, and he's sitting in the, you know, after the arrest in the Texas theater where he's arrested. And this, of course, the arrest reports with a Officer Stringfellow, I believe it is, and other folks that confirm that Lee Oswald was arrested and brought out the back of the theater and arrested and taken away in a patrol car. All this is on record, so it can't be argued with. You know, and then a few minutes later, you know, this guy is sitting. I guess it's the same guy. He's sitting in the El Chico restaurant parking lot, and you know, he looks so strange going back and forth that, you know, some people come over from the and look and take his license plate. And then where does the license plate come back to? It comes back to Collins Radio, which is a big CIA contractor, and then it goes even further from there. But every fingerprint is CIA related, and no, I don't see how anybody can argue that anymore. My opinion.
Yeah, well, they can't. And even if you don't, if you're thinking CIA, I'm thinking military intelligence. You know, the strong arm of the Department of Defense. So if you say, "Oh, well, this is a rogue operation," it isn't all the people working in the CIA building. It doesn't matter. Yeah. That's at arm's length what we're saying. So you have an idea where this is coming from, you know?
Yeah.
Alan Dulles and the big money. And
yeah,
the big money behind the opposition to Kennedy.
Yeah. And it was really big. And of course, they had Vietnam that was, you know, being decided. Would the U.S. actually participate in armed combat in Vietnam? That was so much money to be made there. We all know about the, you know, NASAM 263, which proved that Kennedy was getting us out. And, you know, that was a big deal to an awful lot of people that were used to making a lot of money.
Money there, you know what you're talking about, really? You're talking about the Golden Triangle, the drug trade in that area of the world. And
that's
the
right.
CIA's interest and influence there, and they were about to lose all that.
Yep. And the fact that they weren't, you know, after, again, you know, when you think about the tight-fisted control that the CIA and with help from the FBI at this point, but after the assassination, I mean, look at the people who died that could have shed some real light on the assassination. You know, we all know about David Sperry, you know, and when was he killed? Just a few days after the newspaper came out with the fact that he was being questioned in the Jim Garrison case. But then you look at William Pitzer, who was present at the autopsy and by all accounts had some pictures that show that a lot of what happened in the autopsy was later fake. He was killed by what they said was a suicide right before he retired. And the reason he had told people when he was retiring that he was going to he had offers from networks to produce some programming about the assassination and what he knew about it. And I did a video on Lieutenant Commander Pitzer. You look at Dorothy Kilgallen, who was killed. And we all know the story there where she had been granted an interview with Ruby and she knew some stuff that supposedly she claimed was going to kind of blow the case open. She had to be killed. All of these people were killed exactly when they had to be. When they really became a threat, then they were killed. Dr. Mary Sherman of the Ochsner Clinic, she was intimately associated with a particle accelerator owned and financed by the CIA that no one knew about in New Orleans. And, you know, she may have gotten killed in an accident, but again, she was all part of those CIA operations. And, you know, you can run right down the line with the people that were mysteriously killed, or, you know, a lot of times there were claimed it was suicides. Well, a lot of that makes absolutely no sense.
Lee Bowers, right? One car accident.
Yes,
Lee Bowers.
Yes, right. Exactly.
People who don't know who he is.
Sure. Lee Bowers was the railroad supervisor, and he was up in a little watchtower right behind the grassy knoll on the railroad tracks. And he was someone that saw what he claimed was a flash of light, a puff of smoke that took place at the grassy knoll. He reported it to the FBI, he was told to be quiet. He was told he actually reported that the second and third shot came, there were three shots that he heard. He said there was a second or two pause between the first and the second shot, and then there was almost no pause between the first and second shot, and almost no pause between the second and third shot, which would have proved that it couldn't have been Oswald, because he needed to, he had a bolt action rifle, so it couldn't have been bang, bang, which is exactly the way that Lee Bowers on video described what he heard and what he saw. And then Lee Bowers a year or two later was died in a mysterious auto accident, in which the coroner said that he seemed to be in some kind of a strange shock scenario where they couldn't really understand. So again, he was someone that was a threat, because he had actual information about what had actually happened, that, yeah, of course there was a shooter on the grassy knoll, just like all of the railroad men who saw the puff of smoke. And there's even some photos where that smoke is visible. So it's pretty difficult for anyone to say that there wasn't really a shot from the front side there. And unfortunately for Mr. Bowers, who really was a good guy by all reports, just a great person. I think it's the opinion of a lot of people that because of what he saw, he was eliminated.
Yeah, it's awful.
It is awful. My goodness, you know. So, is it okay if I just go through a little bit of this Robert Vincent story? I'm really fascinated with this, because I have to say, up until about a year ago, I had heard of it, but I really wasn't privy to all the details of it. And then I read the book that came out was by a lawyer that he had, and I believe it was a TV. I believe the other author of the book was a TV anchor who Robert Vincent actually reported the story to after about 20 years in the 90s, after the AARB had released everyone from secrecy agreements. So anyway, that got me really interested in it. And I did a little bit more research, and just to go through it really quickly. This is a sergeant who's Air Force sergeant who's in Colorado Springs, lives there with his wife Roberta. Her everybody calls her Bobby. Solid people. He is one of these guys that really doesn't toot his own horn too much. Just kind of puts his head down, does his job in the way it should be done. Well, he hadn't gotten a promotion in quite a while. Eventually he contacted, Washington and, just kind of asked if they could review his file. And they asked him to come in. So he did. He went, this was like the week before November 22nd. He bummed a flight to from Denver to Washington, D.C., and then he meets with his superiors, and they say, yeah, we can't understand why you weren't promoted either. We're going to take a look at this and take care of it. That was the reason that he was in D.C. So anyway, he's like, oh, great, you know, so he's ready to head back to Colorado Springs. And like everybody in the Air Force then and today, you know, a lot of times you deadhead or you catch a flight when you can, you know, if there is room on the flight when you're on official Air Force business. So he goes to Andrews Air Force Base. He checks in and they say, well, sorry, there's nothing leaving today. But he leaves his name and says, listen, if anything comes up, Colorado Springs, Denver, please let me know. Within not that long, he gets a page. So he goes and he sees the dispatcher. Dispatcher says, hey, we do have something. It's that third plane out there, that C-54. He said, and Sergeant Vincent says, great, I'm going to let me run right out there and get on. So he goes out and he looks at the plane. There's no U.S. Air Force markings on the plane at all. There's no insignias at all, except on the tail. There's a globe and with longitude and latitude logos on there. So it's kind of a globe on a colored background with a longitude and latitude lines that are on the overall logo. But that's it. And he sees a guy underneath doing a pre-flight check, wearing coveralls. But the guy doesn't say anything to him at all. Doesn't even look at him when he's getting on the plane. But Vincent gets on the plane, and he sits on the plane after a while, not too long, just a few minutes. Another guy joins the first guy that's doing the pre-flight check. He's dressed exactly the same. Within 5 minutes after that, they get on the plane. They don't look at Vincent. They don't say anything to him. There's no flight engineer on the plane, which is almost unbelievable with an Air Force flight. So the two guys walk up in the cockpit, close the door. Nobody said a word to Vincent. He's kind of flabbergasted. But the plane starts up right away and takes off. And he's like, well, you know, in the book, he describes it as it is what it is, you know, just really weird. He didn't even see any maps or anything with the two guys that walked up, the two pilots, like you would normally expect to see, you know, pilots carrying. Well, anyway, the assassination happens in Dallas at 12:29. At 12:30, because he looks at his watch after he hears the announcement, there's a short announcement from one of the guys in the cockpit that says the president has just been killed. That's it. Didn't say where, didn't say anything else. No, I'm sorry. The president has just been shot. Didn't say killed. The president has just been shot. That's all they said. And immediately after that, he feels the plane make a sharp bank 90 degrees to the south. Well, after about an hour or so, whatever it was, he's very familiar with Dallas, the city of Dallas, and he sees the Dallas skyline come into view. And they head around, and they end up making a very rough landing on a strip of grass, not in an airport, not at Redbird Airport, on a strip of grass. And
dried riverbed?
Yes, a dried riverbed with a little bit of grass and what he thinks may be the beginning of construction of a road, but he's not sure at that point. But that's where this plane lands. And the C-54 is pretty big, but it's made to be tough. It's made to land in areas like that. Most planes could have never landed there, but they do. They land there. He sees a kind of a shed. Looks like a storage shed for construction equipment, maybe 6 by 8 feet, not very big. And there's a yellow Jeep there that pulls up to the plane. Two guys get out of the Jeep. There's a driver in the Jeep that backs up after that. But the two guys that are in the Jeep, they head directly to the plane. One of the co-pilots comes out because the door is in the middle of the plane. So the co-pilot or one of the pilots, I should say, comes down the aisle, opens the cockpit door, comes down the aisle again, doesn't look at or say anything to Vincent, opens the door. The two guys get on. They all three walk past Vincent. Nobody looks at him or says anything. The co-pilot goes back into the cockpit. The two guys that get on go immediately to the very front seat behind the cockpit and sit there. And he says one of them is about 6 foot one, about 190 to 200, looks Cuban. He thinks definitely Hispanic, but probably Cuban. The other one's about 5'7 to 5'8, about 165 pounds. And who he will recognize the next night when he sees him on TV as a splitting image of Lee Oswald. So anyway, the plane takes off right away. As soon as these guys get on, the plane takes off, heads west. He thinks he's going to Lowry Air Force Base in Denver, but he doesn't go there. When it's dusk, the plane lands someplace. He has no idea where he's at. As soon as the plane lands, the two guys in the seat behind the cockpit get up and leave. The two guys in the cockpit go right behind them. Again, nobody acknowledges Vincent. They get off and they just walk away. So he's left on the plane not knowing where he is and not knowing whether they're coming back to go to Denver or what. So he gets off. He goes. He sees a light inside a building. He goes in. There's a military policeman in there behind the desk. He tells Vincent that the base has been closed and nobody can, he can't leave. He's in Roswell, New Mexico. He's at Roswell Air Force Base in New Mexico. The base has been closed and it won't open up until further notice. And Vincent says, well, what do you mean? We just came in, you know? And the military policeman says, well, I don't know anything about that, but you know, the base is closed. So anyway, about a few hours later, I believe it was 9 or 10 o'clock at night. He tells Vincent that it's okay to go. Vincent goes to the bus station, takes a bus overnight to Colorado Springs. From there, this is, you know, it's really weird. He tells his wife about it, but you know, it is what it is. And you know, he's Air Force, so he's not going to question it too much. But then later that night, Saturday night, the 24th, I guess it would have been, they see on television, you know, that Oswald press conference. And he tells his wife, oh, my God, that's the guy that got on the plane in Dallas, you know. And she says, what are you, you know, it can't be, you know, because he's there, right? And he says, well, he looks exactly like him. And then, of course, the next day he's dead, you know, Ruby shoots him. And they get pretty worried at that point because they know something weird's going on. But so they decide they're not going to really talk about it and just kind of, you know, move on. They're getting pretty close to retirement age and that kind of stuff. So they have plans for not retirement, but when he's getting out of the Air Force. So anyway, about 4 months later, I believe it was April or May of 1964, he gets this cryptic order to go to D.C. Nothing else, just go to D.C., call a number. So he goes to D.C., he's at Andrews Air Force Base, calls the number, he's directed to Langley in Virginia, which is the CIA headquarters. They don't really tell him anything, but with a few other people, he undergoes about 3 or 4 days of really vigorous psychological and physical testing. At the end of that time, he's brought in and they offer him a job with the CIA. And it's really a lucrative job. Like he's an administrative supervisor. This is not somebody that, you know, you would expect that the CIA would really be, you know, looking to get. He didn't have any real skill sets that would normally be associated with the CIA needing. But anyway, he's given a really lucrative job offer and he graciously declines because he and his wife they're going to leave military life in a few years. And he has some ideas for what he wants to do after. They pursue him pretty hard, you know, but again, he says, no, that's it. And finally they let him go. So he comes back. Then a couple months after that, he gets orders that, hey, you know, you don't have a choice in this. You are now associated to ENT Air Base in Washington, D.C. And, you know, and that's where you're going to be stationed at. You don't have a choice, but they don't tell him anything about what his his position is going to be, what he's going to do even. Well, before he even gets to Washington, he's told, don't report to Washington, report to Las Vegas, and then call this number. So again, it's all this secretive, crazy stuff. So he goes to Las Vegas, calls the number, actually has trouble for a day or two getting a hold of people. He finally does, and he's told, okay, go to this place. We're going to pick you up, and we'll tell you what's going on there. Well, what happens, long story short, is they assign him to the airbase at Area 51, which is, of course, about 40 miles out of Las Vegas. And they tell him it's CIA. He's going to be working, you know, on a CIA projects out there. And the real interesting thing about that is that most of the people that are working out there spend all week out there, and then they just come back on the weekends. And that's usually what the procedure is. So what better way to really keep an eye on this guy than to spirit him away to a CIA base, you know, Area 51, where they're working on all the, you know, the U2 stuff, all the really the Blackbird flights, all the stuff that's the most highly secretive stuff, right? Oh, I forgot one thing. Let me just go back a minute. When not long after after the assassination, and I can't remember honestly whether it was he went to Washington for that first CIA offer or not. It was either right before that or right after. He's told that by the people in his neighborhood that the CIA are doing these, they're CIA agents that are doing this. They're canvassing the whole neighborhood, asking his neighbors questions about him and his wife. And then afterwards, he's already signed secrecy agreements. He's got the highest secrecy classification at that point, but they make him sign not only new secrecy agreements for him, but for his wife, Bobby, which is almost unheard of that they would make wives sign it, but they did. So, and she didn't want to actually, but eventually they came around. So that's just one other part of that story. So anyway, he works out at the Area 51 base for the next couple of years. And he and his wife both say it felt like they were basically what it was like a plush jail is what they basically said. They were getting taken care of pretty good financially, but basically they felt like they were in a jail. So anyway, they finally get out. He moves on with his life. He doesn't say anything about any of this stuff until the 1990s when the AARB is in full blown, and it's really bothered him that, you know, that he hasn't ever said anything about this. But you know, when he realizes that he may be released from those secrecy agreements, the first person he talks to is a news reporter that he knows and respects, that's done a whole lot of work in the area. And then they get put in touch with a lawyer who checks out all the secrecy stuff. And they actually call the head of the congressional liaison with the AARB, and he's told that, yeah, it's okay. You're free to say anything you want at this point because of the legislation that passed. So anyway, that's how it goes from there, and that's how his story gets out. He's still kind of worried about the whole secrecy agreement, so he's really careful as he moves along. But that's really the end of the story. So you've got this guy, and he in the book, he's got everything documented. You know, it's got one of the graphic sections in the middle of the book where he shows pictures of every order that he got, you know, from to go to each base and all his promotions and everything. So it's exceedingly well documented that his story is real. And then you go back and you say, wow, okay, why, you know, one of the questions that I would ask right away was, well, why would the two guys that were piloting the plane, why wouldn't they have said something to Sergeant Vincent when they got on the plane in Washington, you know, supposedly headed for Lowry Air Force Base in Denver? And it makes perfect sense when you think about it. They're a CIA. They're part of a CIA operation. They're compartmentalized. So they, I'm sure, think that whoever this guy is part of the operation. And just the same way as he doesn't know what their part is, they don't need to know what his part is. So I'm sure that was probably the thought process. I mean, they don't know what this guy has been ordered to do. So it would make sense, you know? The other thing is then, you know, you figure at 12:29, the president is shot. And then at 12:30, 1 minute later, they make the announcement on the flight. So it's almost like it had to be, they had to be where they were. And why? Because if it didn't go through like Chicago, if the flight didn't, this is my opinion now, but if the flight didn't, if the assassination didn't take place like in Chicago 3 weeks earlier, right? Well, this plane can never be questioned because it's on its way to Denver and it's hundreds of miles north of Dallas. It's not like they went and were circling Dallas. So if someone looked at the flight plan, they can question, right? It's not like they went and landed at that landing strip and were just waiting, you know, to see what happened, because then they could have been seen and probably would have been seen there. So it makes sense that they were in position if they were needed to do that extraction. So they go, they make a quick extraction, and this second Oswald, the guy who probably came down from the Texas School Book Depository and got in that green Nash Rambler that Roger Craig saw, and then who knows what he did after that. We know he ended up in the, or at least another Oswald looked like. We don't know that there was just one, but if it was the same guy, then we know he ends up in the Texas theater. We know he gets arrested in the Texas theater. We know he's seen in the El Chico parking lot, you know. So what he's doing there, who knows? You know, that might be all part of the Tippit situation there. They probably want him seen in the Tippit shooting so that everybody will identify who this guy is. But, you know, long story short, it can't be questioned that this Lieutenant Vincent was on that plane and saw somebody that looked like Lee Oswald, a Lee Oswald imposter, get taken up from a makeshift airport 5 minutes south of the railroad tracks behind the grassy knoll just along the Trinity River, and then has his life controlled by the CIA for the rest until he retires, and then probably long after that we don't know about until the 90s when the AARB came to fruition. Len, I think that is an incredible story that I don't understand, and I don't see how anybody could question him because he's got everything documented, and I just can't believe that his story hasn't, you know, over the years, attracted more attention than it has.
Yeah, it's a very interesting book. I believe I had James Johnson, is that the lawyer, on?
Yeah.
And Flight from Dallas. And yeah, it's astounding. And like you say, whether you believe it was Lee or Harvey, it was a lookalike. It was somebody involved in a military operation. Could have been the shooter, dark-complected man also in the Rambler. Dark-complected man spotted in the window, you know. Just so many things that go against the Warren Commission. It's as if they have written some kind of Santa Claus fable, you know.
And the fact that his life is controlled by the CIA in wacky ways after it, you know, is just proof that they were, you know, I really believe he probably never knew how close he came to being off himself when you look at what happened to a lot of the other witnesses. If he would have been identified as somebody that was really talkative and maybe he was talking about what had happened to him to people in his neighborhood or kind of, you know, what they would have considered shooting his mouth off, he probably wouldn't have been around very long because that's one of those direct stories that is pretty
like thinking
hard
of like a George Demornschelt, right?
Where
he's going to testify and then, oh, he put a shotgun in his mouth, right?
Exactly. Anybody that believes Demornschelt shot himself is I don't know. I got a bridge to sell you because you know, when and again, when does he die? When does DeMorin Show die? He dies when he's being questioned, you know, by the
House Select Committee.
The House Select Committee, right? And then, you know, so he needs to be killed because of what he's talking about. You know, again, it's a really an interesting story. I didn't know that much about it, and I was kind of flabbergasted the more I started looking into it. And hopefully I'll have a video on it in the next week or so. So I'll send you the link to it, and anybody that wants to watch it, you know, they can check it out.
Yeah, it's fantastic, really. This story, and it's good that you have an interest in it, because that's what it's taken interested citizens to look into these things and to be questioning the government that we don't believe this at all. And I hate to, but I've got to just say something about the Trump election and that this assassination attempt, when that kid was up on a building, mm-hmm. a slanted roof, and he got up there with a ladder and a gun and a rangefinder, and nobody saw him, and he was there for half an hour, and everybody was on stand down mode. No, let him take the shot first. Let him take the shot. Okay, you know, I mean, it's just unbelievable as well. And you go, I think from my point of view, why do I study this? They go, well, we want to learn what's going on so maybe we can stop it from happening again.
Yeah, exactly.
But, you know, this stuff can still be going on, right?
Yeah, I'm sure it is.
Right. Well, with that, right? What happened to the guy's phone records are wiped out. The house where he was meeting somebody has been professionally cleaned. You know, no fingerprints anywhere. It's just astounding. And then when you look back to, like, for instance, the same thing with the Martin Luther King assassination. Like, who was this hapless guy that happened to leave his gun and identifying in a duffel bag right there, you know, and all that. And this is a real lesson, history lesson, in how somebody thinks they're going to join the government to do something, to maybe do something for bettering the country. Well, we got to check up on the Soviet Union. Can you go over there and learn and then come back and report to us? And yeah, we'll pay your way back. Yeah, we'll bring your wife back. What's the guy's name? Rakin? Baz Rakin, that met him from the State Department to give him money, you know, when he got back. It was never big. You know, I mean, the whole thing sinks. And of course, we agree on that. But I'm just so glad that you're doing continuing work, and you say that you're getting ready to retire, so you'll have more time, so there'll be more videos coming our way. That's great.
I'm psyched up about it, Glenn. I really am. And, you know, I just want to say, anybody that's, you know, it's actually, every time I'm on your show, it's just such an honor and a pleasure. And you have done, and I know you're a humble guy, so I know this is probably hard, but you have done such good work. I mean, for so many years, and I can't tell you how many times I've gone back and listened to interviews that you've done with people to get a perspective or to find facts that I need for my research. And you keep coming up with all these great guests, and you know, just man, hang in there, because you're doing a real service for everybody in the community. And I just wanted to thank you, man. Really good.
Well, thank you. And also, the thing is that when you think you've got an angle on something, and then there's more information that comes out. And, you know, just the fact that they're holding on to these records, and then Biden just said, we're not going to release anything. At least Trump had kind of implied, I'm really interested to see what's going to happen on the JFK files. And then the next day, I've been told we can't release them. Sorry. So, and then it's going to pass on it. And I think maybe, who knows, maybe we'll be lucky with this new administration, like with Robert Kennedy Jr. in there, they might say, release the files, right? And I have feeling there's going to be, well, I know there's going to be some new names in there. That people don't know about, that's why they've been holding on to him. Because if they were already out there, if it was all, you know, Alan Dulles or Ed Lansdale or other people have already heard of, but these are the people higher than them, big money, big organized off the books money, off the books. When you're talking about Golden Triangle, when you're talking about banks in Bermuda, in Jamaica, you know, even in Australia with the Nugent Hand Bank thing, you know. Big CIA money that reared its head and said, help us out, Alan Dulles, we need you, you know, can you be down on the farm there? Can you start something, you know? And like in the movie JFK, he makes a phone call and he says, we're going to move somewhere in the south in the fall. We need you to come up with a plan, right?
I mean, even the CIA, that's the thing that I think sometimes people don't realize how much funding that they control. Even back in the day in the Ochsner Clinic in New Orleans, where Ochsner had such close ties with the CIA, and they had put a there was a particle accelerator. There was only like four of them in the world at that time. And they were like $10 million, which was a hell of a lot of money. I mean, it's a lot now, but it was really a lot then. And, you know, it was paid for entirely by the CIA, put in the public hospital in New Orleans. And it was used to conduct research on how to produce a fast acting virus that could kill Fidel Castro. And Mary Sherman was part of that operation, and even Oswald was part of the operation, in that he was but it was really David Ferry when he was killed in his apartment, and they found all those mice. Well, they were part of that. That was all part of the operation where they were doing that research over at the hospital. So, you know, Lee Oswald had actually had a part of that operation too when he was working for Guy Bannister.
Yeah, they got him to apply for a job there, didn't they?
Yeah. Well, no, that was the actual hospital in when they went to
somebody identified Clay Shaw there because of his weird stature.
Yeah, exactly. It was with Clay Shaw and David Ferry and Oswald had gone. So that was.
But just imagine that those three people.
Yeah.
So there you go. There's some operation that other people, knew how to hijack and said, "This is great. We're going to use this guy. We're going to use this guy." You outline it in Chicago where they had guys lined up to take the fall.
Yeah,
who
exactly.
knows in Miami, but in Dallas they did it. Okay, look, I just want to make sure that people knew about your channel and
thank you, Len.
So you've got more in the works, and very interested to hear about your take on the flight from Dallas and Vinson.
Awesome. Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Okay, sorry, I was just coughing there, right?
Okay. No problem.
Good, then. Before we wrap up, is there anything else you wanted to add or just bring up or talk about?
No, I think we went through everything that I had on my mind. Thanks to your listeners for putting up with me. I appreciate it.
No, it's very interesting, and I highly recommend your channel, and there's lots of stuff there. I mean, just an awful lot. So I'll leave it at that. And keep in touch and do let me know when you got something new. I'll be glad to promote it and also have you back on to talk about it.
Thank you again. I really appreciate it. You have a good week.
All right. You too. Thank you. Good night.